Welcome everyone to the sixth and final class meeting time. It won't be the last time we're together, and I hope to see you all on Saturday. But as we have for each of the other classes, we'll start with a 30-minute meditation in which I'll review all the instruction. And rather than add another dimension to the instruction tonight, we will explore the attitude by which and through which we meditate. So take a posture of meditation, if you would. So what does that mean, a posture of meditation? It means a release from the tension and drive and speed of our life. One of the symbolic reasons we leave our shoes at the door is to establish the intention to step out of the day's activities. And you can see that very quickly, there can be a deep sense of repose and relaxation just in the reminder that we can do that at any time. We can release the tension within ourselves at any time. Remembering that the back should be straight, the eyes soft, the jaw relaxed, moving the shoulders back and away from our neck so that they're unrounded, and softening our belly so that there's an ease of motion and effortlessness with the rising and falling of the abdominal area. And last, but certainly most important, is the releasing and relaxing of the mind itself, is the settling in, is the arriving into the meditation psychically. Meditation isn't trying to figure out the worries of your day, or trying to put order and control and influence within the structure of the day, but rather to see and to observe the immediacy of the moment, this moment in which we live, and resting in this moment. And we do that by finding our breath as the tether to this moment, as the reminder, as the sensation that reminds us that this moment is continuing, often without our presence, but it is continuing. And when we acknowledge our breath, we acknowledge the moment as it is and release ourselves from the persuasion of our thoughts. And as we release ourselves from thinking, first go to the sense of physical relaxation and mental ease, so that that is the embodiment of the meditation. And then allow the breath to be found from that sense of tensionless ease. And as other physical sensations may predominate over the breath, we can take our mind and place it on those competing sensations, not waiting for the breath to reappear or for us to have less of a problem with the competing sensation so we can go back to the breath, but to bring our whole focus on that other sensation. And when and if it becomes less predominant, then returning to the breath. And if an emotion should arise, we can feel the embodied sense of that emotion, feel what it feels like within the body, as well as acknowledging the mind state of the emotion itself, being very careful that we don't get lost within the content, the explanation and justification of the emotion, but stay very physically based. If one of the hindrances should arise, that is desire, aversion, sleepiness or dullness, restlessness and worry, or doubt, to know and to acknowledge the fact that they have entered our consciousness, that they are there, to know they are present, is the all-important difference as to whether we lose ourselves within that hindrance or can meditate upon it. Just feeling it, allowing it to pass, to come, to go. Finally, we opened up the field of our sensation to include sound. Often it's good to start the meditation with just the sense of sound, because it allows the mind to be very spacious and broad, less confined and constricted. Just listening, not allowing thought to determine what we are listening to, but just hearing what the ear hears. Last week we included the whole range and presentation of thinking, and the difference in being lost in thought and meditating upon thought is knowing that thought is occurring, knowing that I am thinking, knowing that thought is arising. Because we are just beginning our meditation practice, we shouldn't rush into thought prematurely, but wait until we are lost naturally within thought, when it moves away, our breath moves away. And just see before we come back whether we can know we're thinking. Oh, I'm thinking, okay. And then releasing the thought, coming back to the relaxation of the body, and then allowing the breath to emerge from there. Staying with one object. And it doesn't matter if there are a number of things occurring. If you feel sleepy, you have a sore knee, and you're irritable, pick one. And just stay very simply with that one object. Pick the most predominant object within your field. And if nothing in particular is occurring, you can always go back to the home plate of our breath and just rest there. So there's always something that one can attend to. Remembering that meditation, the definition of meditation, is knowing when something is occurring. And we either know it or we don't know it. So there's no halfway that we can meditate. Be full-hearted and sincere. Don't play with a little bit of thought and fantasy and then go to the meditation object and then play a little more into the field. But really, for the time that you're sitting, give a full-hearted participation in just noticing the beginning, the middle, and the end of whatever sensation you're making contact with. Stay very relaxed and soft with whatever sensation is arising. The meditation practice and the attitude that is so important is the attitude of receiving the experience. We're not trying to fix it or do anything with it. We're not trying to control it, and we're not trying to make it end. We're just receiving what is there in a very receptive, settled back posture. We allow whatever life is bringing to be received, to be listened to. So the art of listening is very much the art of meditation. We're not adding our own story to what's occurring, nor are we embellishing what is already there. We're simply noticing what is there in its entirety without any judgment or identification with it. So the attitude that we sit down with is the attitude, okay, let me see what's going on here. Let me just notice what is arising. Let me listen to what is playing in my mind and body in this moment. Like going to a play or movie. It requires your attention. It requires your full-hearted contact. And it requires your ability to listen and to attend and to receive. And all of that requires your relaxation. The secret of successful meditation is that we intuitively know when we're being sincere and complete in our response to an object and when we're meeting it halfway, when we're listening halfway. We know when we're attentive to someone, if we're listening to someone speak, and when we're too engrossed in our own busyness. In meditation, we also know that. To be willing to give up our self-focus, our self-indulgence, and really listen to ourselves, with whatever experiences are playing on our consciousness in that moment, is the art and science of meditation. Soft, allowing, attentive, that's the practice. And now we'll sit for 15 minutes. We'll end the sitting with a poem from Mary Oliver, The Buddha's Last Instruction. Make of yourself a light, said the Buddha before he died. I think of this every morning as the east begins to tear off its many clouds of darkness, to send up the first signal, a white fan streaked with pink and violet, even green. An old man, he lay down between two solid trees, and he might have said anything, knowing it was his final hour. The light burns upward, it thickens and settles over the fields. Around him the villagers gather and stretch forward to listen. Even before the sun itself hangs disattached in the blue air, I am touched everywhere by its ocean of yellow waves. No doubt he thought of everything that had happened in his difficult life. And then I feel the sun itself as it blazes over the hills, like a million flowers on fire. Clearly I'm not needed, yet I find myself turning into something of inexplicable value. Slowly beneath the branches he raised his head. He looked into the frightened faces of that crowd. Make of yourself a light, he said, and then he died. May all beings make of themselves a light. may all beings depend on no external conditions for their sense of aliveness. May all beings shine brightly regardless of circumstances. So you're welcome to stand up and stretch a little bit before we have the talk. So first I'd like to congratulate all of you for being the graduates of 2002. I think it's my 40th class.
You get diploma?
No certificates, no diplomas. You get your breath. So, what have we been doing here? What has this 6 weeks been about? And can I just see the hands of people who are coming to the day long? Great, good, perfect. And we'll have some ride coordination at the end for people who need rides. Don't let me forget that. What we're attempting to do is to make our lives workable in a way that they have not been. And to make our lives our own. And in so doing, come into a field of aliveness, of vitality, that has in some ways been distant to us, if we've been in touch with it at all. I keep a sign on my desk that says, "Do not ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive. And then go out and do that, because what the world needs is people who have come alive." We spend too much time focused outward, thinking about what and how to help or serve, and very little time focused inward on deepening and enriching that inward life of our own aliveness. Whatever we do from that sense of aliveness will feed the world. We misappropriate our aliveness by asking the question externally before we ask it internally. Where is it and what is it that makes me come alive? That's the right question to guide your life and direct it. So often we get lost in the side inducements, the secondary inducements, as to what we need for security, rather than what we need for vitality. And if we can just uncover or perhaps go back to the original intent and purpose of why we're doing whatever it is that we're already doing, we can often uncover or dust off that aliveness once more. That's what the meditation is about, increasing our vitality and aliveness. And we hold it at bay through our inward judgments, our inward turbulence, our commentary, our self-criticism. What we have to do in order to be fully alive is to fully experience ourselves, because every aspect of our experience is part of our aliveness. Doesn't that just make sense? And if there's anything that we're denying or repressing, we are then thwarting or blocking that particular form or expression of our aliveness. Once we understand that to be fully in touch with ourselves is to be alive, then our work and what we need to do is easily known. There is no aspect of mind that does not contain part of your vitality. And to uncover and recover that part once more is to gain a foothold back into our authenticity. And what we have done is laid out the mind. It's as if we had a broken car. And we laid out all the pieces of the motor, scattered them out all over the room. And we're going to observe every facet of our mind to see if there's any problem anywhere, in anything. All of our emotions, all of the hindrances, the patterns that we live with, all of our aversive responses, all of our delights and attractions. We scatter them out. We look at one, each one separately. We shine the light of our attention upon each one. And we find that there's nothing to fear in any of them. And then we can allow them to all come back together and to work properly, synchronistically, and in accordance with our aliveness. And so what we have done is take that lamp, that torch, and searched out whatever part of ourselves we feel disadvantaged for having. Our anger, our loneliness, our unforgiveness. They're not easy parts to include. But when we learn that we can hold anything as long as we don't judge it, as long as we don't react to it, we can just hold it. It's just what it is. Remember that it's always only this much. It has nothing else, no other form of persuasion over us. It is only this much. And if I can hold this much, I can hold it. And when we find ourselves relaxing with it rather than feeling betrayed by it, it begins to feed us rather than deplete us. Even fear. Okay. And what we understand is it's been our relationship to these component parts of ourselves, not the component parts themselves, that has been the problem. And so we acknowledge it, open to it. Okay. This will give us a greater sense, an expanded sense of spaciousness within ourselves as we do learn how to be equanimous, balanced, non-reactive to each and every event, incident, experience in our life. What opens from that non-reactivity is spaciousness, inward space. And suddenly we're not confined or constrained, and certainly not self-critical or judgmental. And there's a kind of ease and harmony that comes from knowing that inward space very well. There's a story in the Buddhist literature about a man who was ill at the time and sends his young grandson to the Buddha to find out what the Buddha taught. And so the young grandson goes and asks what the Buddha taught, and the Buddha says, I teach ethics. Sila, it's called in Pali, S-I-L-A, sila, or ethical conduct, moral conduct. And the son runs back to his grandfather and tells him, and the grandfather says, go see if he's teaching anything else. And a second time the grandson comes and he says, yes, I teach wisdom. And so the grandson goes back, and again the third time he's sent back by his grandfather, and yes, the Buddha says, I teach another thing, I teach steadiness of mind, non-reactivity. And then the son goes back and comes back a fourth time. The Buddha says, no, that is all I teach. I teach a moral, ethical life. I teach a life that is based upon wisdom. and I teach a non-reactive steadiness of mind. Let me talk a little bit about those three components and how they involve every discipline, every tradition, no matter what form of religion we come out of. The first is the ethical code. The ethical code, I can already see some of your eyes glaze over, is not Ten Commandments. This is not thou shalt be good. We've already discussed how the intention to be good creates the shadow ever looming over our need to be ideally good. It's not that. Rather, from a free consciousness, from a whole consciousness, from a relaxed and totally relaxed and whole consciousness, there is a sense of interconnectedness that is seen and understood, a view of interconnection. And the ethics, the component of ethics, lead towards that view. Let me explain. The first of the five precepts in Buddhism is to refrain. Listen to how it's stated. Not thou shalt not, but I undertake the practice to refrain from taking life. When we refrain from taking life so that it isn't an automatic that we stomp something out, when there's a mosquito on our hand and we don't automatically slap it, we pause, we consider the mosquito's life within that pause. Not just our own life in reaction to the mosquito's, of the aversion to the mosquito. When we do that, we are more inclusive, a more interconnected sense of ourselves, not our life being betrayed, but all of life having its own purpose. And the honor of that life is considered within that pause. It does not mean thou shalt not kill. You take antibiotics. Every time you breathe in or step on the ground, there's something, some microorganism or other that dies. It doesn't even mean that you should not eat meat. Many Buddhists eat meat. It means the moment of violent striking is such an arrogant statement in which we are cut off from any sense of interconnection, needs to have a pause, needs to be considered. We need some space between ourselves. And that automatic response of extermination. For an example, we were sitting in our living room in another house, and this big rat crawls under the kitchen and under our bookcase. This is not a fish story. And so I saw that thing and I said, I can't live with that. So we started to build traps, but have a heart traps, where you put a little peanut butter in the middle and you have the rat comes in, and supposedly the doors are supposed to close and you take the... But the rat somehow was able to eat all of those things and escape. So then we built this one where we had this, this 20-gallon... waste basket, which is about this high, and we put books up to the top and peanut butter in the bottom of it. So the point was that it was supposed to smell the peanut butter, jump down, eat the peanut butter, and not be able to... But this rat shot out somehow from the bucket. So whatever we did, it countered. And you could hear it under the... We would sleep and you could hear it under our bed and the woodwork below, chewing the wood. So what do? You see, you pause. Okay, we're pausing here. Then the 12 gauge. No. You pause and you consider. You consider. You think, okay, you take this life into consideration. You don't just... All right, so that... It's the pause that's important. I'm not going to tell you what I did. But it's the pause that's important. So to refrain from taking life, to refrain from. That's the first precept. Now, these precepts have another very important component. They keep us from being paranoid. I don't know about you, but I grew up with in a family of five kids. And, you know, somebody was always taking the cookie, the last cookie, taking two cookies instead of one cookie. And we weren't wealthy. We were middle class, but there was a limitation on that. And there was somebody always sneaking it. And you learn how to survive in that kind of environment with brothers and sisters. And you learn how to shade the truth or darn right tell a lie or whatever to sort of get through situations that would be painful. And that way of relating to life stuck with me after I left home. And you find I found myself sort of leading with a shading of the truth rather than with integrity. And I was always kind of checking to see if anybody would discover or find out what I had said or anything. And then as I got into the meditation and learned the value of just honest communication and honest behavior, suddenly the paranoia, I wasn't turning around anymore. Well, when we turn around, we're not present. To be present, now the phone rings and I have no, oh my God, is it? No, it's nothing like that. And there may be miscommunications or mistakes I make, but when the intention hasn't been to harm, which is what the precepts are about, then there's easily self-forgiveness. And the burden of my past is no longer fostered in the present. You see? So the first precept, to refrain from taking life. The second precept is to refrain from taking what isn't offered. Refrain from taking what isn't offered. So basically it's about generosity, really. The willingness to feed rather than to deplete. The willingness to give back rather than to take ownership. I mean, we really didn't check to see if everybody had paid and whether you could afford paying or anything when you came into this class. We just assumed that you were good at your word. And we then live on whatever monies that we get from that. And this whole thing is based upon that principle. So the shadiness of how we deal in life in the marketplace requires a new pause, a new intentionality to it. Okay, how do I want to be known in this life? You know, sometimes when people are dying, they're close to dying, and they're very cantankerous or irritable or selfish, and you can feel just the energy just kind of being consumed by the patient. Sometimes as a social worker, I would ask the person, I would say, how do you want to be remembered? Is this how you want to be remembered? Arguing and bitter and cynical? Sometimes you have to be very direct to break the film in front of their eyes to realize that this is the memory that they're bequeathing to their loved ones. How do we want to be remembered? What's the right epithet for us? That he got his share? You know, I never heard anyone die and say, I'm really going to miss my Mercedes. Never heard that. Or, I wish I had worked longer hours. Never heard that. You know, you begin to feel that the resonance of the heart is all we've got. And the precepts allow that resonance. It allows the continuation of that resonance, the growth of that resonance. Because they're based in non-harm and therefore in non-selfishness. The third precept is to refrain from saying what is not true. Refrain from taking life, refrain from taking what is not given. And that second precept has to do also with quantity. I mean, have you ever been given something? I remember in my job there was an M&M dispenser. It was like a big M&M, and out of its mouth, if you pushed its handle, came a peanut M&M. So I would go by the reception area and in and out several times a day, yanking on that arm. And suddenly I realized, I wondered, who puts the M&Ms into that? And I asked the receptionist, she says, oh, just people from time to time will bring a bag in. And when I realized, in perhaps my sixth month of being there, I would go to Costco and buy some of these huge bags of it. Because you can only take for so long before it feels, I don't know, it just, you know that commercial where they haven't eaten their vegetables? And they walk like, that's what it feels like just to take all the time. Like you haven't eaten your vegetables. The third precept is to refrain from saying what is not true. If you look at why it is that we say a lie or a distortion, it's for self-protection. And if you investigate why it is that you protect, it's because there's some part of you that I am ashamed of. And I don't want to show that. And when we look at that and be able to authenticate that, relax with it, regardless of what it is, it means coming out of the closet in all aspects of ourselves. I don't care if somebody, then that's, whose mind is it that reacts to me being a certain way? It's not me, it's you. It's your disadvantage, not my disadvantage. And if you don't like the fact that I have a particular personality or characteristic or whatever it is, religion, sexual orientation, or whatever it might be, the prejudice is in the person who is observing, not in the person who is having. And if we can relax with the way we are, doesn't mean, but within the field of non-harm. Not harming anybody by being the way I am, just being the way I am. Quirky, if we're quirky. So when I examine that, which the precepts are a call for self-examination, when we violate the precepts, it's not for self-condemnation, it's not for moral, you know, it's not like a televangelist crying, you know, it's not that. It's like, well, what was going on here? Where is their greed operating? Where is their fear operating in me? Let me look at that. It's a call for self, not for, you know, guilt and shame, but just, let me look at that. Okay, why am I lying? Let me look at that. Why am I lying? And I got into that very strongly when I was first taking on the precepts and I was very moralistic in my ideas of what I should and shouldn't do, and I started keeping a lie notebook. And my lie notebook, what I would do is every time I distorted the truth, I would make a mark in a notebook, and then I would count the number of marks I did that day and compare it to what I had done the previous day. So I was sitting there and somebody came in and we were talking and I distorted the truth somehow, so I took out my notebook and made a mark. So the person says, what did you just do? And I lied to him. At that point, I threw the notebook away. Because we can use these precepts to bind us into counting how good we are. Get the spirit of it. The spirit of it is not high morality. It's basic goodness. It's kindness. It's non-harm. And to look at what it is in the reasons that motivate us towards harm, when we correct those motivations, when we look and observe those motivations and release ourselves from them, what is the baseline after we release ourselves from harm is non-harm. It's not like a new activity we have to do. If we learn to be authentic, we won't lie. Lying comes from the need to distort our perception. Be able to handle who we are, we don't lie. Isn't it amazing? See, basic goodness is the default position. So we're not asking us to be anything different than what we are. Just release ourselves from the tension of greed and fear that permeates and distorts our character. So, refrain from taking life. Refrain from taking what is not given. Refrain from saying what is not true. Refrain from sexual misconduct. Sexual misconduct is not celibacy. We're not monastics. But it's to take the whole person into consideration within the sexual act, not just the lust component. Because enormous amount of harm and manipulation comes through lust when it's just the greed intention rather than through affection, which is the wholeness of two people getting together. To refrain from sexual misconduct. It also means not getting involved in established partners. You know, leave people alone because there's harm. There's harm. It hurts everyone. And there's all this kind of seediness and paranoia of phone calls and secrecy and all of that stuff. When you really see how torturous it is, it's not worth whatever gratifications we seem to glean from it. And the fifth and final precept is to refrain from drugs or drink which cloud the mind. Refrain from drugs or drink, which doesn't mean that you can't have a glass of wine or beer or something like that in a social context. It does mean that if you're an alcoholic. But if you can handle one, then that's fine. But to take it so that our consciousness becomes cloudy and confusing, when the whole point of meditation is to establish the clarity of consciousness, the clarity of view, to be able to see what we're doing and to acknowledge and to know what's occurring. If you think drugs and drink, they don't allow you to know what's occurring. So therefore, meditation is interrupted. And so we just refrain from that. We just refrain from the overload. And many of us have gone through a number of drug experience relationships in which they have been beneficial. Perhaps they've expanded our consciousness in psychedelic drugs, if you're from that era like I am. But when you realize that the greater joy and fullness is to have a non-induced clarity, then there's just this kind of release, enjoyment that comes, joy that comes from that, rather than artificial. So those are the five precepts. I'd like you to really think about those and reflect upon them and choose one of them for yourself to work with, perhaps wise speech. But here is the great caveat when you choose one. Don't let it come back and increase your shame and guilt, because if it does, you're using them in the wrong way. They should enliven us, be something of interest, not a burden. You can feel the difference between when we use it as a morality statement of whether I'm a good person or bad. It's like this heavy weight. But when we use it to investigate where it is that we are losing ourselves, then it's a buoyancy. It's joyful to, let me look at that. Let me look at this. God, I can't believe I just said that. Why would I say that? What was going on there? And we actually look at the experience of what is happening. And therefore the whole thing rises up. And that's the difference between using it skillfully and using the precepts unskillfully. So if you're going to use them, watch for the reaction of shame and guilt. So the Buddha said he taught sila, and that's sila. Basic integrity. I mean, if I stood up here and lied to you about what this practice does, how could I do that? What would I do? It's hard for me to imagine that anyone would do that, but I know sometimes that's done. But when you base yourself in harmlessness, then what the heart does is it wants people to be gratified. It wants people to rise up. It doesn't want an uneven distribution of power. It's not about positionality. It's about interconnection. And interconnection is equal, always equal. So the motivation really becomes one of alleviating suffering so that people can come up to eye level. And then the Buddha said he taught Panya, P-A-N-N-A. Panya is the Pali word meaning wisdom. So what does he mean by wisdom? The difference between wisdom and knowledge. Knowledge is when we have a lot of facts about something, a lot of opinions about something, when we've done research on it, when we know how it acts in certain conditions and all of the different ways and influences. Wisdom is when we see something directly, then it begins to be integrated into our life in a completely different fashion than when we have the knowledge of what it is. The Buddha said, a single moment of insight, which is what we're talking about, that direct perception of something, is worth 10,000 years of being a good person. Because when we see something directly, the mirror, the glass is etched. And when we're just trying to be good, we're not seeing anything. We're just living according to a particular ideal at the expense of our wholeness. And what this practice does is it allows us to know things directly, which is wisdom. And then the Buddha said, he taught a third thing, which in Pali is called samadhi, or steadiness of mind. It really doesn't have a Western word that we can say that concentration really isn't the same as samadhi. Samadhi is a steady quality of mind, an unshakable quality of mind, a kind of oneness of mind that no longer reacts upon every experience that might come up. It just holds experience and allows things to arise without being shaken by them. That kind of equanimity or poise or unshakability is really where Buddhism leads. So that everything that happens isn't an emergency, isn't an urgency. It isn't even a problem. It's a challenge, perhaps. But it doesn't create the tension and stress that most problems cause in our life. And so he taught that through sila, there's a steadiness that grows from the lack of paranoia. And once that samadhi begins to hold the field steady, I can then see and participate and observe directly what is there, which is wisdom. And as my wisdom increases, I see why it is that I should do what I am doing, and therefore my sila improves. And as my sila improves, my samadhi gets steadier, and as my samadhi gets steadier, my wisdom gets deeper. And the whole thing is a circular staircase. It just keeps going deeper and deeper and deeper, embedding itself into a truer and more authentic representation and display. That's what we're doing. That's what this practice does. That's where it leads. It's based in kindness. Because, as I have said many times, without that sense of heart appreciation, of heart resonance, nothing works at all. And when and if we challenge our greed, our selfishness, it is not something that needs to be sought. The heart is, again, the default position. We find the heart by the alleviation, by the elimination, by the letting and release of our selfishness. When we're not thinking about me, the heart interconnects. It's amazing to behold, and very true. And so I'm going to stop talking now, and we're going to take a 5-minute break, and then we'll come back and we'll ask questions, if you want, or comments. And then we'll get through as much of that as we can, and then I'll talk to you about what the next step is for people who would like to continue this particular practice. So if we could have a 5-minute silent break right now. So no talking, if you won't mind, just holding the value and attitude of stillness, and meet back here in 5 minutes, please. Okay, so we can start with any questions or comments you might have, and then go from that to the resources that are available, and then we'll end with a metta meditation. Yes?
You mentioned that, that one direct insight is better right. than a number of good deeds.
Right.
Can you give an example of kind of...
Right. So the question is about what is an insight, or how do you what kinds of things arise in terms of insight? An insight that most of you had and is a pretty startling insight, although you didn't perhaps recognize it as such, was when you sat down and saw how little control you had over your mind. You probably didn't know that. You probably didn't realize that the mind wandered as much as it did. And when you directly observe that, that's very different than reading in the book, The Mind Wander. You could have read 10,000 Buddhist books and done good deeds. But the single moment that you actually see that, you go, my God, I can't get this thing to stop. That's very different. You see, that's a different kind of knowledge. That's an ingested knowledge. That's an ingested understanding as opposed to a mental knowledge. You'll have insights on lots of things. Some of the insights come on the ephemeral changing qualities of life. It's one thing for me to say life changes and you look around and say, yeah, it changes, good. It's another thing for you to go in and experience your body and mind as being in transition. Nothing solid in there. Everything is movement. When you actually have the experience, the integrated experience of seeing directly that there's nothing solid in there, that changes you dramatically as opposed to reading about it, you see? And so every time we come up and observe a certain component part of ourselves, we see it very differently than our mind knows it. For instance, when you hold your anger, you develop a whole different relationship to your anger than playing it out. And you realize that you can hold it. That's insight. So insight is the willingness or the ability not to bring preformed judgments or opinions to something, but rather to let that something be seen for exactly what it is. And when it's seen for what it is, there's a whole different way that we experience life and ingest it rather than to play it out in terms of memory. Well, good deeds are not insightful. Good deeds are usually performed in wanting to help it's not that good deeds are bad. It's just that good deeds aren't usually insightful. You can go out and do a lot of things, but never realize from where they come. Oftentimes, good deeds is because we feel so bad about ourselves that we're trying to cover over the black hole of our own sense of insufficiency by pouring out what other people need and serving them. And never realizing where that comes from doesn't really allow us any sense of change and respect to it. You see? So just action and good deeds themselves don't allow for wisdom necessarily. They allow us to feel good. And again, it's not that good deeds don't come from wisdom. Service does come from wisdom. But it comes from seeing the interconnection, the experience of interconnection, rather than trying to get over some insufficiency. No, no. The question is about taking what is not offered and whether it means that you have to sit there and the monk, that's actually one of the monks can't ask for anything. One of the rules of being a monk is that you don't ask for anything. It has to be offered. So that's a whole challenge in and of itself, but that's not what it means in its heart of hearts. It means that you don't steal, basically. That's all. I mean, it's, you know, when I was a monk, I could have taken my most valued possession, which wasn't much, but I could have taken and put it in the middle of the path, and no one would have touched it. Everybody would have just left it alone. Try that out on the streets of Seattle. It just, because we don't hold the precept. You know, when you're coming from a sense of I want or I need or possessiveness, then taking or manipulating is how most of us respond to the world. But when you're coming from a sense of non-harm and interconnection, then what you want to do is be generous to the world rather than deplete it. So it's not that you can't ask for things or, you know, or at all, but rather that the general directions of one's life is towards being generous and sharing, rather than being selfish and protective. Yes?
I'm interested in knowing a little bit more about how to cultivate non-judgment, because while my mind is wandering all over the place, I'm thinking, oh, crap. Not getting very far with it. And, you know, a million other kinds of things.
Sure.
So
yeah.
I know that you encourage people
right.
not judge, but
right.
I'm going there anyway.
Right. So the question is about judgment and how to cultivate non-judgment. You don't cultivate non-judgment. You just release yourself or watch or observe your judging. When you're aware of something, you're not bringing anything to that thing. When you're just aware, if you're just listening, like just listen, you're soaking in, you're taking in, you're receiving what is there. There's no judgment involved in that, is there? There can be if you're meeting what you're hearing with a whole opinion, but if you're really taking it in and just opening yourself up and just receiving it, there isn't judgment. That's how we want to be with different contact with our experience. We want to just receive it. So it's not, and judgment comes from the mind, it doesn't come from the awareness. We bring judgment to, and so we just have to be aware that we're judging. Okay, I'm judging, I see it. And don't add judgment to your judging. Oh, why am I judging? What's the matter with me for judging? Don't do that or you're just compounding the problem. So when you notice yourself judging, just notice yourself judging. Okay, judging, judging. Then you're not bringing anything to that. You're just being aware of judgment that is already there. But you're not adding any fuel to the fire. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it's the lack of attention.
Right.
And busyness that I'm most judging.
Okay. So the lack of attention and busyness is going to require, if you wish to do this, it's going to require sort of a long practice. It's a long, it's not something that happens overnight. you just have to be patient with that whole busyness. And I will outline a whole array of different events that you can do to kind of speed your practice up a little bit. Because right now it's just at the formative phases. And it's going to have a lot of busyness, and you're going to be judging a lot, and you're not even going to know you're going to be judging, and you're going to be lost in it, and you're going to be, what is good is all this? And you're going to be judging even sitting, and it's just going to be one problem after another. So in order to give you a little more motivation and a little more, you know, speed you on down the path a little bit, we have a whole number of things that I would like to suggest you do, which I will as soon as the questions are over. No, I didn't say think. I didn't say think about any of those things. You got to. The difference is you were not thinking about. The question was, the first week I said think about your breath. The second week I said think about the sensation. I never said that at all. I said, right, be aware. Be aware of your breath. Make contact with your breath. The experience of your breath, not thoughts about it. Those were my words. Thoughts about your breath are thinking about your breath. That means you're just up here thinking. When you find yourself thinking, release yourself from it and just make contact with the experience of it. How do you know you're breathing? What experience occurs? And that is where you want to be, the experience of the breath, the movement, the physical movement of the belly going in and out. That's not thinking. The experience of pain, what it actually feels like. Not, oh, I hate this pain, this is so terrible, oh, how am I going to get... Not that. What's the experience of this? What's the experience of touching the rug? What's the experience of that? You can... Right, right. So is it possible for us to know that we're thinking? Then you're not thinking about thinking. You're experiencing thinking. Don't worry or think too much about that, because it comes very naturally when the meditation deepens. And you'll have occasions when you will be sitting and actually hear your thoughts, like you're hearing me. And as that occurs, you'll begin to see more and more the phenomena of thought. In Buddhism, there are six senses. The five that we know and the mind's activity. Because the mind's activity can also be, we can be aware of the mind's activity. In the same way as you can be aware of sound, sight, smells, taste, and touch. So don't worry too much about it. Stay grounded in the body, which is the ground thing, and let that other develop naturally in the course of the practice. Refrain from saying what is not true. It includes harsh speech or backbiting or gossiping. You can feel the energy. If you're ever with a gossip, you know, at the water cooler, the whole energy just kind of feels like whirlpool, right? And they're looking, people are looking for you to add to that momentum. And it takes a great deal of integrity, really, not to allow the mind just to go down and down deeper into it. It feels terrible, actually. Gossip feels terrible. But because everybody's doing it, we then think, oh, it's okay for me to do it too. And just not to do it.
Well, what if sometimes you're in a situation where, like, there's a distortion of the truth, and you're not really speaking honestly, but if you speak honestly, it's not going to be too well received. And I think that happens a lot in a lot of work situations.
Yeah, okay, be careful here, because you can find reasons never to be honest. So don't build problems prior to them occurring. And when problems do occur in which you find honesty difficult, ask yourself, why is this difficult for me? Is it because I want everyone to like me? Is it because I don't want to be seen as being different? Is it because I'm trying to hide something from other people's points of view? Is it that I'm trying to protect myself from other people's opinions? None of those reasons for me hold a reason why I can't be authentic. And so we just say what we say, and we say it kindly. You see, you have to look very deeply into what it is that's motivating us to distort things. Not just say, I can't do it. The Buddha said, don't say just what is true, say what is true and useful. So it's not just a matter of stabbing people with what is true, because what is true can hurt, and that's not kindness. It's timeliness, or whether the person's ready to hear it, or the person, or whether it's appropriate even to say to somebody. If somebody says, you know, how do I look, and you think they look heavy, it may not be the time for you to share that opinion. And so, if you lead with a heart, you won't go wrong. And the heart doesn't back away from because it's afraid. It backs away from saying something because it doesn't want to cause harm or hurt someone. And so then we say things that are true. The heart won't distort. It'll say something what is true, but it'll be timely. It'll be, in Buddhism they say, sati sampajana. Sati is awareness, mindfulness. Sampajana is clear comprehension, or the context of how it is that we're saying something. And it's the context that allows the heart to come in. Yes?
There are other types of meditation, and I'm wondering what the Thabo practices might get in the way of the practice of insight meditation, and what do you...
There are other types of meditation, and how do those practices get in the way or complement this particular meditation? There are really two types of meditation. One meditation attempts to stare at a candle flame or do a mantra, or we could say it's one-pointed meditation, where the object is just made to rest and focus and sustain itself upon one thing. And that leads to one. There's another meditation, which is what we're doing, that leads to zero. That is, that we want to be able to sustain our attention upon something, but then we want to know what that something is so that wisdom can be communicated or can be allowed through that contact. So if we just say a word over and over again, that doesn't allow for much wisdom to come through. But if we take what it is that we have learned in terms of focus and steadiness, and then put that internally on our mind and see how it is that we're operating, we can then become, have increasing understanding as to why it is that we are the way we are. And so wisdom will develop from that sustained attention. So sometimes one-pointed meditations can complement the practice, and sometimes it can detract from the practice. If, for instance, you're sending your mind off to Hawaii and just thinking about images that were very beautiful, that may allow you to sustain your attention and just hold it upon one thing, which is the image of last year's vacation or whatever. But it doesn't do much about wisdom, and it doesn't do much about allowing you to come back into the present moment and to be present to things. So most practices that I would suggest for you, I would recommend having some basis in the here and now. There are Christian contemplative practices like Father Thomas Keating, who has done Buddhist meditation. He used to be the director of, or the abbot of Spencer Abbey when we were at IMS, and we would do Christian Buddhist dialogues, and they would come over and do Buddhist meditation. And he does what's called, I think he took from Vipassana, he calls it centering prayer or listening prayer, in which he just has the Christian sit down and listen. Receive God in form of experience. not that prey in terms of act, but to receive. And that's essentially what we're doing, you see? So within the different traditions, you can find Vipassana or insight practice, but you should be sophisticated after doing this course well enough to know whether a practice brings you into the here and now and allows you to know what's going on, or whether it doesn't. And if it doesn't take you into the here and now, what real good is it for you? It may give you a little more pleasure, a little more joy, a few moments of remembering and recollecting and that sort of thing, but it's taking you away from a more vital sense of aliveness, which is here and now. So it should all come down into your being able to claim your aliveness here and now.
At the beginning of the class, you had us look a little bit at why we started meditating. And I find now that I'm a little distanced from that. I feel like I'm bringing all these goals to meditation and trying to solve things with it. Like,
yes.
She asked about self-judgment. Like,
yes.
I meditate, that'll help me with my self-judgment.
Yes.
Get rid of it.
That's okay. And the question was about, at first I asked you for the motivation of why you're sitting, and now this woman finds that she brings a lot of tasks and achievement orientation to the meditation. The patterns that we live with are going to be a part of our meditation for a long period of time. We only know certain strategies and how to work with life, and those strategies are going to come into our meditation. And they're going to seem to be, they work very well for me getting through school or whatever it is that I have achieved. But when we sit down, we begin to notice how those patterns that, since we've conditioned them so strongly into us, begin to play through the themes of meditation, just as you've stated. And you're beginning to notice that. And at first, when you notice that, you go, oh, you wouldn't be saying it right now. You go, oh, God, this isn't what it's about. But you're more aware now of those patterns in your life, even though the awareness isn't very pleasant. You're more aware. The awareness is working. The mindfulness is working. And as you see yourself in getting more and more embroiled in those things, you're going to start challenging them. Okay, what's the value of me working out tasks? Well, you know, it gives me this and this and this and this. What's the limitation? It doesn't allow me to really receive life from any steadiness or stillness. So you're going to find the value and limitation, and then you can apply that strategy when it's of value, and you're not going to be, or you can release yourself from it when it's not. So you're in the beginning phases of seeing these patterns as they implode upon your meditation, and it's a good thing, not a bad thing. Now let me tell you a little bit, because we're a little running out of time, a little bit about the opportunities that the community offers. It's very helpful for most people to sit with other people. Seattle Insight, acronym SIMS, S-I-M-S, Seattle Insight Meditation Society, is a community of people who are interested in doing this practice on an ongoing basis. They, again, don't have to be Buddhists. I don't ask you to come into some ordination or initiation at all. But rather, you can be secular and just use it in whatever tradition you're in. But the interest is in exploring mindfulness practice, insight meditation, towards one's own spiritual awakening. We sit on Monday nights over at Beth Shalom, which is 6800 35th Avenue Northeast. What I ask people who come to that is that they've had the introduction to the meditation that you've had. You're then welcome to come to any Monday nights or none at all. You don't have to start at the beginning of a series. You can come anytime. Anytime you are welcome. And you'll always be welcome. It's not groupish. It's not cliquish. In fact, you should be welcomed by people. They're on their toes to, if then they see somebody new, to introduce themselves to you. And what we usually do is we have a sitting of 45 minutes, so a little longer. Then there's a Dharma talk, which is what I have been doing after the sitting for about 45 minutes, and then question and answers, and then I give homework. And then we come back the following week and we discuss that homework in small groups and in large groups. It feeds the vitality and gives us an ongoing way to work this meditation. This practice, as you can see, is very, very difficult. Easy to state, but very difficult to do. Most people find Sangha, which is the community of other people practicing in the same way, very helpful to supplementing and complementing their own practice. But that's not the only thing. SEMS also offers a variety of other teachers, names, if you stay within this practice, that are very well known, like Joseph Goldstein, Sharon Salzberg, Christina Feldman. Christina Feldman was just here. All of these are authors and, you know, meditation teachers of reputable and experienced meditation teachers of 30 or more years. Sharon Salzberg wrote Loving Kindness and wrote a book on faith. She's going to be here in the middle of November in a non-residential retreat for beginning students and experienced students, where it's like 2 day-longs, where you go home in the evening. And I just want to encourage you to come to these events as you see fit. She's also going to do the Monday night class on November 18th, and she'll be speaking that night. So oftentimes the speakers for Monday night are people other than myself, because we try to get an array of different teachers through here. There's no cost, no suggested donation, but we do ask that people donate $5 if they can per class. If they can't, they're welcome to not give anything. And there'll be a Donna basket for me after those days. So you can come free or you can come and contribute if you like. And there's no obligation. There's nothing. It's just free will. You just come and participate if you so wish. We try to keep all our events at absolute minimum costs for that reason. It's just an organization that has the point and purpose to be integritous and to communicate as fully as it can the richness of this particular tradition. Now, we also do residential retreats. And if I were going to start meditation, if somebody asked me what's the best way to start meditation, I would say do a week-long residential retreat. Because when you've done a residential retreat, you come out of that, you know what meditation is. And it will change your life. It will change your life. If you do it the way you've done it, you kind of sputter a little bit. And you may not have the resolve or have the confidence that you can do residential retreats. That's what the non-residential, the day-long is for next Saturday, is to give you some confidence that you can do this thing for the course of a day. If you're interested, I'm teaching a residential retreat at the end of November and the beginning of December. And there's still room at Cloud Mountain, which is a small rural retreat center about 2 hours south of Seattle, down by Chehalis. And it's for beginning and experienced meditation. And it would really pick your practice up. You'd leave the retreat and you would have a deeper and more fundamental sense of what this practice is about, and it would enrich your daily practice as well. And that's just one retreat that I'm doing, but there are many, many retreats that Cloud Mountain offers that other very reputable teachers are doing that I would encourage you to search and pick one for yourself. We have a website, Seattle Insight, all one word, Seattle Insight, insight.org. O-R-G. And on that website, you can find all the activities that we do, all the teachers who are coming, and you can find all the talks that I've done, plus the homework, including the talks in this series. If you'd like to go to that website and listen to a talk, you can find them from this class on that website, including tonight's talk. You can download the talk. You can keep it. It's all free. You don't have to pay anything. The homework is up there on the web, plus the talks I give Monday night in case you can't come Monday night in person, and the homework that I give Monday night. And so you can listen to the talk and read the homework and then do it on your own if you're so moved to do it in that way. So there are a lot of resources. I left a resource list back there. I hope everyone picked it up. It has a list of periodicals and magazines and books and places that are very alive in this tradition. And so look that over. And the yellow sheet of paper is the list of events that Seattle Insight is offering now through the beginning of the year. I also left a sheet up there on a correspondence course. Some of you don't feel that you want to get involved in a group, or it feels funny, or I don't know what, but there's lots of reasons that people would rather do it on their own. And so there's a correspondence course that you can do for like $150 or something. And you get tapes, and it's by Joseph and Sharon, two reputable teachers, and you get someone who you can write to as a mentor that will correspond with you for a year in this correspondence course. And it's good if you're at home or you're disabled or you just don't want to go out and you just want some ongoing ways of working. So that's a nice resource there as well. There's also homework up there for letting go. It's by a quote by Ajahn Sumedho. The theme of letting go is the last homework that I offer you, and I'll bring a complimentary homework on the weekend for you to take this Saturday. But that sense of releasing ourselves, you know, when you first come in and you just sit here and you just release the day, that's letting go. We carry so much tension perpetuating our problems like Santa Claus. And we can just release the burden of that any moment by just, okay, let me just bring myself here and now. The longer and more steady our presence is here and now, the less baggage we can carry. It's directly, inversely proportional. So it's been a joy to be with you for these weeks. I'd like to end with a metta meditation, but before I do, I want to do ride coordination. Anybody that doesn't have a ride that needs a ride for this weekend, would you just raise your hand? Would you mind saying where you're from?
Sure, I live on Spinning Ridge.
Anybody can give her a ride from... great, so you connect? Great, good. Anyone else need a ride? Wonderful. Any final questions before the metta meditation that you'd like to ask? We have... Yes?
I have a quick question. Sure.
I would say go and see. There are different traditions within Buddhism. There's the Tibetan tradition, the Mahayana or Zen tradition, and the Theravadan or Vipassana tradition. We're from the Vipassana tradition, and each of them, all the traditions have at their foundation the teachings of the Buddha, mindfulness practice. And then each of them have a cultural overlay associated with them. Tibetans, of course, is from Tibet, and it has all of the... imagery and all of that from the Tibet. The Zen tradition, for the most part, is Korean or Japanese influence, and you have the rigors, and so it's just a matter of temperament and finding your own resonance. This tradition, we like to keep as Western as possible and as free of cultural overlay as possible. But if that doesn't connect with you, explore the other traditions and see and find one that does work with you. Any other questions? Yes. What street is that on? It's 6800. You can get off our website, 6800 35th Avenue Northeast. There's a, is it Unitarian Church? Unitarian Church that's right across the, and Beth Shalom is a Jewish temple, and we meet in the recreation room. It's a large carpeted room, about twice the size of this room. And there are about 100 or more people who come. Yeah, so it's a sizable gathering, but it's a great group of people, and I mean, what you'll find is that this meditation brings good people. You don't find a lot of thieves wanting to meditate. Because all it's going to do is show them their greed, and that's not what they're looking to. They're looking for other things besides that. So it brings good-hearted people. And if you like to be around good-hearted people. Okay, so let's finish with a metta meditation. And let me just say how much of a pleasure it's been. This has been a very nice group of people. And I just want to really thank each and every one of you for coming and being a part of this. And I look forward to seeing you on Saturday. So if we can just take a seat. And allow yourself to focus your attention in your heart area as if there was a hole that passed right through your heart and that you could breathe in and out of that hole. Not your physical heart, but your energetic heart in the center of your chest. And allow yourself just to be tender with that space. To be caring about yourself. Being sensitive. Sensitivity is the willingness to touch something. And so we're going to touch ourselves. And sometimes ourselves kicks back. It doesn't like being touched. It doesn't feel deserving of being touched. That's okay. That's okay, we're going to touch it anyway. And we have the intention to be kind in our touch. We have the intention to hold ourselves in kindness. So let the word kindness be a part of how it is that we just touch ourselves with awareness. May I be kind. May I know the path of kindness. May I learn all the ways I'm not kind and be kind to those ways. Just softening the heart, allowing the heart to be gentle, to be felt, to be appreciated. May I be free of fear. May I be safe and free of danger. May I be kind. And to move now our intention towards others, to allow the heart to come into full contact beyond our own body into the community. May all beings be kind. May all beings be kind. What a world we would live in if people could just actualize that one statement. May all beings be kind. May all beings be safe and free of danger. And now coming back to ourselves once more. And I would like you to form an intention in your mind of a direction in which you want to live your life. It could be towards greater awareness, towards greater kindness, towards more authenticity. Whatever feels right for you, set that intention in your mind. My life will be about this. Set it. Set it from the heart. Set it from something that is so meaningful to you that from time to time you may stray, but you'll come back. So that when you die, you can say, my life was well lived. Thank you all for allowing me to share with you. I look forward to seeing you all along the Great Way, but particularly this Saturday. So I'd like to take a special moment and thank the listeners who have been following this series online. I know it's much more difficult to follow talks and a series of talks when we don't have the accompanying presence and interpersonal contact that these classes have in their original intent. But I want to say that it can be done through an online taping if the person follows the instructions and diligently applies him or herself to the homework and really tries to encourage that sense of self-investigation so that their life can be full and complete and rich, and to take that time throughout the day to pause, to bring forth that sense of collectedness and non-hurriedness so that there can be a deeper and richer sense of meaning in each and everything that you do. And so I want to thank you for listening, and I want to encourage your practice in any way that I possibly can. I hope that we can perhaps meet sometime in a more personal way, and I wish you the best of luck all along your particular path.
This concludes the Seattle Insight Meditation Society 6-week beginning course in Insight Meditation. SIMS is now offering an online mentoring program to our internet community conducted by advanced meditation students. To discuss issues related to your practice with a mentor, please send a blank email to the address mentor, that's M-E-N-T-O-R, at seattleinsight.org, which will generate an automated reply sent to you. Follow the instructions in this email to request an online mentor. Welcome to the practice.